Welcome. My name is Professor William Schniedewind. I'm the Kershaw Chair of Ancient Eastern Mediterranean Studies at UCLA. I'm also on the advisory board for the Center for Jewish Studies. The Kershaw Chair is one of the many sponsors for this event. This is the second talk in the 2017 Bible and its Interpreters Lecture Series, sponsored by the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies and co-sponsored by the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department, the Department of Anthropology, as well as the Study of Religion. I want to give a special thanks to Chelsea and the staff here at CGS for doing all the arrangements for this lecture series. And I also want to remind you to go to the back wall, and on the table there are all the events, many events that are going on in the Center for Jewish Studies, really fantastic events. The last lecture, for example, in this series will be Lauren Monroe on February 21st, 2017. Lauren from Cornell. I saw Bob Alter is coming from UC Berkeley. Many other events going on, so sign up on the sign-up sheet. A lot of fantastic events. Okay, with that, I'd like to turn to our lecturer today. We are very privileged. I feel especially privileged to have Professor Susan Ackerman here. She's the Preston H. Kelsey Professor of Religion at Dartmouth University, where she's also a member of the Program of Women and Gender Studies and the program in Jewish Studies there. She's been teaching at Dartmouth since 1990. She came after teaching at the University of Arizona. And she's a specialist, and I would say probably one of the world's leading authorities in the religion of ancient Israel and the religions of the ancient Near East. She first developed these interests as a student at Dartmouth and her graduate studies at Harvard, and her first book on the goddess Asherah, I think, is one of the classics and most important works in the field on the goddess Asherah. She's the author of many, many articles, and most recently a new book, When Heroes Love, The Ambiguity of Eros in the Stories of Gilgamesh and David. It was published in 2005. She's currently the president of the American Schools of Oriental Research, which is an international consortium of schools dealing with the study of the ancient Near East. We're very privileged to have her here, and I'm going to turn it over to Professor Ackerman. Please give her a warm welcome.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks. Does that sound good? Thanks. It's really, really lovely to be here. Not just because, as Bill indicated, he's an old friend, and it's great to be his guest here. But I am especially privileged today that at Dartmouth we're a solely undergraduate institution, and in my 27 years at Dartmouth, I've directed about maybe 20 or so undergraduate honors theses. 10% of my honors thesis students are here today. So two of my students who did honors thesis with me subsequently came to UCLA. One of them now holds the PhD in Near Eastern Languages from UCLA, and one of them is currently a student in the same PhD program. So I'm just really honored to be able to be here, and especially to have my former students here. It makes me very proud. What I want to talk to you about today is an interest that I began to develop several years ago when I became interested in these things that are called model shrines from ancient Israel and also from ancient Jordan. These date from about 1200 to roughly 600 BCE. And they're called model shrines because, as you can maybe see in the image behind me, they're small little box-shaped terracotta objects, and they are small. They're only about this tall. I know you can't quite see the scale in the one behind me, but they're small box-shaped terracotta objects, and they're meant to represent in miniature a shrine building. And I became interested in these, and particularly interested in a kind of subset of this corpus that had female figures flanking the entryway to these shrines. And you're just looking at the subset I was particularly interested at here. These are kind of classic of these little box-shaped shrines. These two are a little bit different, but seem within the same basic genre of terracotta objects that are meant to represent some kind of architectural building and have females flanking the entryway. And the reason I became interested, or so interested in these, is because these seem to me to be the closest analog that I could think of, at least, to a biblical text in the book of Exodus, chapter 38, verse 8. And that text referenced to the so-called Sabaoth women who are set to tzavah at the entrance to the ancient Israelite tent of meeting, the sacred space, according to biblical tradition, that preceded the building of the temple in Jerusalem. Now this root, or this word, Sabaoth, the Sabaoth women who tzavad, and those three consonants that are there, the t, the ba, and the uh, those three consonants in Hebrew most typically refer to some kind of military connotation. The noun Sabah, for example, means an army. But because there's a few passages in the book of the biblical book of Numbers where these three consonants can be used to refer to religious service, the most common translation that you find of this passage today, and it's the one that I've put in parentheses here, is that these Sabaoth women served in some kind of religious way. They were some kind of religious servitors at the entrance to this cultic space, or this religious space, the ancient Israelite tent of meeting. I myself am somewhat more attracted that we should think more seriously about the military connotations of Sabah. I'm attracted to this first because this is a sensibility that is reflected way back in ancient translations of the Bible. I've put here on the slide the translation of the Bible into Latin done by Jerome in the early 5th century. And in Jerome's very famous Vulgate translation, these women are called the women who excubabant, or the women who keep watch or guard. And I think what Jerome is really alluding to there is that we should understand this in a more military sense, and that's the translation that I've suggested to you here in the English, that I would prefer, that these women guarded at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And this is also, at least I would propose to you, the same interpretation that we should have of these female figures who flank the entryways of these model shrines and related objects. And I would note in this regard that guardian figures are exactly what we should expect as the entryway to a sanctuary space. As the renowned scholar of ancient Canaanite and Israelite iconography, Otmar Kale, has written, and I quote here, "That which is holy must be protected to the extent that all manners of guardians safeguarded a temple entrance." And in the ancient world, these can be many, many different kinds of guardians. So, for example, from a temple site that is in northern Syria, or I hope it's still there. It's hard to know what's still there in Syria today. But a temple site in northern Syria at a site called Ain Dara, we find the ruins of a temple from about the 10th century BCE, where, as you can see here, there is a sphinx who guards the entryway to that temple space. Those of you who know the Bible might think of the way that cherubs guarded the entryway to the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden. According to a Syrian text from ancient Mesopotamia, The Assyrian king Esarhaddon also fashioned kuribu, that's the same word as the biblical word for cherub, to guard the entryway of the temple of Ishtar of Arabella, and also to guard the entryway of the temple of the god Ashur. In the reign of Esarhaddon's son in Mesopotamia, King Ashurbanipal, guardian figures who were called either Lamassu or Shedu were placed at the entrance to a temple. And they are moreover explicitly identified in these ancient Mesopotamian texts as being guardians, or more expansively, figures of stone which, according to their nature, ward off evil. Guardians can also take the form of lions. Here's an example again from Ain Dara, where I think you can see these lions that are flanking the entryway to this temple. And from the late Bronze Age in the Upper Galilee in the Canaanite realm that eventually became ancient Israel, here are lions, or here's a lion this lion and its companion flanked the entryway of a temple from this city at Hatsor. So guardians are, these kind of guardian figures quite typically are found at the entryway of ancient temples, and similar guardian figures are quite typically found at the entryways of some of these smaller models of ancient shrines or temples. So here's a small model, again, this only stands about 8 inches, 7 inches tall or so from ancient Megiddo, and what you're looking at here, this is the best photograph I have, I'm really sorry about that. But you are seeing what are pretty degraded, but these are cherub figures. You can see their human heads, their legs, and their wings. I hope back here, here's the other one, the head over here, that flanked the entryway of this shrine at Megiddo. Another shrine that comes from the ancient Israelite context from a site called Tel Rekesh, and I'm just showing you the location of Rekesh on the map here, has lions down crouching down here. They're again pretty degraded, but maybe you can just tell. These are lion figures. This is, again, the best image that I have. I'm sorry. Lion figures that flank the entryway of that model shrine. From a very recently discovered model shrine from a site called Kirbet Kiatha, which is just south and west of Jerusalem, as you can see on the map here, comes this little model shrine. And notice the lion head here and also here. And most interestingly to me, from a site called Pella, which is on the Jordan River, just to the east of the Jordan River, comes this object from about the 10th century or so. What you should be looking at here are these two lions' heads flanking this entryway. You can see it here as well. And standing atop these lions' heads, these two female figurines, the things I told you that I was particularly interested in. Like these lions, my argument would be to you that these female figurines perform the same function, that they are also guardian figures, and I'm hardly the only person to make this argument. So for example, at a site called Horvat Kitmit, which is deep in the south of what we think of as Israel, archaeologists discovered a bunch of fragmentary remains from model shrines. So these are the fragments here. And the noted art historian of Israel, Pahiria Beck, when she tried to reconstruct what these fragments would have looked like on a model shrine, described her prototypes as our model from Pella, as a similar model that is today found in the collection of the American University at Beirut, and as a cylindrical model that comes from ancient Megiddo. And in all cases, she described those shrines as having female figures who protected the object in question, just as she argued that object, that the women she was working with protected the shrine she had reconstructed. Beck also cited a fourth example that comes from ancient Karak in modern-day Jordan. You can see it down here, just to the east of the Dead Sea. This model shrine, this is the one that was on my title slide, that has these two flanking females that she described as guarding this model shrine. Now, this particular shrine interests me for another reason, which is that these two female figures are shown clutching disc-shaped objects to their chest. And this is hardly unique within the corpus of these model shrines. I want to show you several examples. Before I do so, let me just tell you what I'm going to try and prove by showing you these several examples. That I want to suggest that all of my examples are going to show female figurines who should be understood as guardian figures, who guard and safeguard this shrine, and particularly safeguard the god or the gods who are housed within from whatever malevolent agents might seek to breach the shrine's entry. That, as many scholars have proposed, the discs that they hold as they stand at the entryway to these shrines are drums, and that one of the ways that they affect their safeguarding role is by beating on these drums, and that the loud and booming noise of these drums forms a deafening clamor that drives malevolent agents, and especially demonic agents, away. And from this is going to follow a fourth and final argument that certain figurines that we have from ancient Israel that are not attached to these kind of model shrines, but also show female figures holding these disc-shaped objects, should also be understood as guardian figures who drum away demons. So, that's a lot to try and prove, and I think I have like 20 minutes, so let's see what I can do. Let me start just by showing you the various examples of model shrines that have these female figures that are holding discs. I've already started with this one that I'm still showing you here, the one that comes from Karak in Jordan, just to the east of the Jordan River. The next one, this Karak shrine, I should say, we think it comes from Karak. It actually was not found in an archaeological excavation, and so it entered the collection of the Jordan Archaeological Museum in the 1980s, bought from the antiquities market, but is said to come from the vicinity of Karak. This shrine also does not come from an archaeological excavation, and I show it to you with some reluctance because it's not in the collection of a museum. It's in a private collection, or it was in a private collection of a collector named Shlomo Mushayev, who died in July of 2015. I honestly don't know where it is now. I assume it's still held by his heirs. For scholars, this is a tremendous problem, this issue of materials that are held in private collection and so not readily accessible to the scholarly community. And I show you this, therefore, with some reluctance. But for my purposes, it's a really kind of too important to ignore. As you can see, this is yet another one of these model shrines. This one, unlike many of the ones that I've shown you, is an extremely elaborate one. It doesn't just have that little box shape, but it has this very elaborate facade in front of the box shape. It has a very elaborate entablature that goes up from this facade. And notice as you look at this facade, what you're seeing here, two female figures on each side of the facade, paired with a lion, which again I think suggests their guardian function. Each of these female figures is holding a disc shape in her left hand and then with her right hand atop the disc, just like in the Karak shrine. Above are two busts of female figures, above each of the full figures, which also are holding, it seems, a disc shape. And then there are another 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these female busts decorating the entablature, all which are said by the archaeologists who have been able to study this shrine that they are two holding one of these disc shapes. So a total of 9 different figures here of females holding discs. My next example actually was found in an archaeological excavation, very near Karak, in fact, or fairly near Karak, a site that's called WT-13, or Wadi al-Tamid 13, that has been excavated by the Canadian archaeologist Michelle Davio. And Davio has reported that in her excavation, she found this fragment that she reconstructs as also coming from one of those entablatures, one of those elaborate facades of a model shrine, as you can clearly see here. Again, it is a female figure who holds a disc to her chest. Davio found four other figurines at site WT-13 that similarly hold discs to their chest. And in all those four cases, she reports that they show evidence of having been attached to something on their back. They have evidence in the clay that they were attached to something, potentially, as she says, a model shrine or some other kind of ceramic stand. Davio has also drawn scholars' attention to a very similar object that comes from the site of El Balu, also in Jordan, just east of the Dead Sea. The object, as you see here, in very fragmentary condition, but does hold a disc again against her left breast, and again shows certain evidence here of having been attached to something. So again, potentially attached to a model shrine. Those examples all come from Jordan, from across the Jordan in what we think of as modern-day Israel, and from ancient Israel. I can give you some examples from the site of Tel Rehov, which I'm just showing you on the map here. From Rehov come this one complete figure, which is on the left, a more fragmentary figure, which is on the right, and actually a third figure that is even more fragmentary still, all of which seem to show a female figure who's holding a disc, again, against her left breast in this pose that I hope now looks relatively familiar to you. And with this female figure, if we flip it so that we see her from perspective, you can again see that it was it has clay in such a way that it was attached to something and potentially again attached to a model shrine. The tradition of model shrines and similarly related objects is well known at Rehov, and I'm just showing you five out of the 34, 35 or so different examples of model shrines and similar architectural model objects that were found by archaeologists at Rehov. I've also briefly mentioned already the remains that came from the south of modern-day Israel, a site called Horvat Kitmit, and mentioned to you the one model shrine that had been reconstructed from some of those remains there. This is actually one of four. What's more interesting for my purposes at this moment is also in these remains at Horvat Kitmit were these six disc-shaped objects, and you can just see on some of them that these were also objects that originally, before they were broken off, were somehow held. The archaeologists who have worked on these objects suggest that they were held by a female who held them as discs against her left breast, and that they in turn were attached to some other object like a model shrine. So we have a fairly, I think, impressive corpus of these females holding discs who may be or who definitely were associated with these model shrines, the two complete models from Karak and the Masayaf collection, the more fragmentary models from Wadi Tamid 13, from El Balu, from Rehov, and from Ketmit. So, what's the disc? I don't want to belabor this point. This was actually something that has been fairly widely debated in the scholarly literature about, 40 years or so ago. Some people suggested that the disc was a loaf of bread. Some people suggested the disc was a plate or an offering bowl. Some people suggested the disc was a representation of the solar disc. And some people suggested that the disc was a small drum. I would say recently consensus has really emerged around this interpretation that the disc is a drum, and more specifically a frame drum, described as a kind of hoop-shaped drum with a diameter that's much greater than its width. That looks basically like a tambourine but without the jangles on it. I'm perfectly happy to engage in that debate about thinking about it a drum, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to ask you to accept with me that consensus that it is a drum, and to try and argue to you what's much more important for my thesis, that these drums that are held by these guardian figures are meant to make a loud and booming noise that drives demons and other supernatural beings away. Now, this is kind of hard for me to prove, because in fact, in biblical literature and elsewhere in literature from the ancient Near Eastern world, there are a lot of texts that I could cite for you where supernatural agents really like drums. Is they like musicians who play drums and who play in musical ensembles to make delightful music that is pleasing to the gods and brings them enjoyment. That said, in the same way that as I was coming to Los Angeles, I was thinking some of you at least probably have taken pleasure in hearing the timpanist play with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and at the same time been deeply irritated by the colleague who drums his or her fingers on a table during committee meetings, ancient Near Eastern gods feel exactly the same way. Sometimes they really like drums, and sometimes drumming noise, but noise more generally, can drive them mad. Many of you may well know this text that comes from ancient Mesopotamian tradition, from the so-called Enuma Elish, at the very beginning of the Enuma Elish, the myth of the Enuma Elish, where the god Apsu is so tormented by the noise made by the younger gods that Apsu cannot sleep and is in so much pain that he resolves that he would like to kill the younger gods rather than continue to deal with their noise or their rigmarole. Or also from Mesopotamian tradition, from the mythological text, the so-called Epic of Atrahasis, we get this text from the god Enlil speaking about how the noise of humanity, again, the rigmarole of humanity, has become so oppressive that Enlil cannot sleep and determines to do away with the humans. This is what sends ultimately the great flood in the story of Atrahasis. We also have traditions from Mesopotamia where demons are deeply bothered by noise. Now, in the text I'm showing you right here, these demons are actually benevolent demons. We think of all demons as being bad, but there actually are some good demons. These are benevolent demons, the demons who help watch over a household. But as you can see, I hope, in this text, these demons who help watch the household, the Kusarikum, has been awakened and frightened even by the noise of a young infant who is squalling, presumably, through the night. Moreover, in Mesopotamian tradition, there are texts where evil demons are deeply bothered not just by noise, but by the noise of drums. These come particularly from a series of texts that, as you can see here, are called the Ituku Limnutu incantation series. And in these texts, repeatedly, we get this evidence about a copper drum that, when beaten, drives away evil spirits. You're seeing one example here. Here's a much longer example here. I particularly like this one because we learn about the names of so many demons, right? That the beating on this copper drum, who is given this name, the hero of heaven, this epithet, through the noise of its splendor is going to drive away the Utuku demon, the evil Alu demon, the evil ghost, the sheriff demon, the god and bailiff demon, the evil Lamar. Mashtu and Labatsu demons, all of these are going to be driven away by the noise of this drum. And here's just a couple more examples from this same series of texts, where now we see yet more demons who can be driven away by the beating of a drum. It's very helpful for me for my thesis. I would say the only negative aspect here is this is not a frame drum. This is a big copper drum that makes a different kind of booming noise. That's when you bang upon metal rather than our frame drums, which are banging upon skin. But better evidence, I think, for thinking about frame drums as having a role in driving away demons comes to us from ancient Egyptian tradition. And I'm particularly thinking from ancient Egyptian tradition of the materials that are associated with the Egyptian demigod Bes, or more accurately, the eight or so different deities who in Egyptian tradition kind of coalesce around this common image of the god Bes. Bes is a protector deity. He protects people from scorpions and from snakes, and he also and particularly protects women who are pregnant and women during childbirth. He does this by what the folklorist Alan Dundas has called a like against like kind of mechanism, that when a malevolent demon shows up to cause harm, let's say, to a woman in childbirth, that demon's demonic gaze is attracted away from the woman he intends to harm and towards Bes, because Bes himself is so horrific looking, as I hope you can see here, that the demon's eye is drawn to Bes and away from the woman to whom he would potentially cause harm. And so these Bes amulets are really quite ubiquitous in Egypt from the Egyptian New Kingdom through the Roman period, both in Egypt and I think importantly for my purposes, also in ancient Israel. And I'm just showing you some examples here that come from the ancient Israelite context. So Bes drives away demons because of his absolutely horrendous looking countenance. The other way Bes drives away demons is by some of the weapons that Bes bears. Here you're seeing the weapons of knives held up over Bes's head and snakes held in his left hand that he can use in his protecting role. And Bes also, I think, arguably uses drums as part of this protection. Now, sometimes, to be honest with you, Bes makes happy music with drums. Here's very famous examples from southern Egypt, from upper Egypt, at the Temple of Philae. But notice that these come pretty late in Egyptian tradition. If we move into earlier Egyptian tradition, here into the early 14th century, from materials that come from the ancient Egyptian tomb of Yuya and his wife Thuya, I think we see better evidence of Bes using a drum in a protective role. These two beds come from this tomb. I'm sorry I don't have better imagery of them for you, but this is the best that's out there, at least I've found in the literature. This was my attempt to get a slightly better image, actually, just a month ago when I was fortunate enough to be in Egypt. But the Cairo Museum, for those of you who have been there, know that the lighting is terrible and the glare problem is atrocious. So I hope you can forgive the glare here. But what we're looking at is the headboard of this particular bed down here. And I'm particularly interested in this panel on the headboard. What you're seeing here is Bes here on the right with his characteristic weapons of the knife and the serpent. But notice Bes here on the left with a drum. And I would suggest we need to read those as mirror images. Beth, in both cases, is forming a protective role. Certainly on the other bed, Bess, on the images of the headboard there, is performing a protective role. And if you can just see here, he's dancing, and he's dancing with knives that are strapped to his feet. I always find this quite scary. I don't know how you dance with knives strapped to your feet, but evidently it somehow is a way of making this protection happen. Also in this same tomb, we find this absolutely stunning chair. And notice what I'm interested in here are the decorations on the side of the chair. On the left-hand arm, we see this. Bess here with his knives in a protective role, and Bess here with his drum, I think also in a protective role. In the middle is the hippopotamus goddess, who is the goddess associated with childbirth. On the right-hand side of this same chair, very similar imagery, Bess dancing with knives, Bess dancing with drums, in the same way, I think, both as images, as weapons that he uses to drive away evil. Other images similarly that come from ancient Egypt include this absolutely beautiful statue that, as you can see, comes here from the site of Akhmim. This is, interestingly enough, the hometown of Yuya, whose tomb we were just looking at. So I think we should interpret it as exactly the same way. Somewhat later, from the village of Deir el-Medina, the village where workmen who worked on the tombs in the very famous Valley of the King lived, we find this particular tomb of one of these workmen, a workman named Ipui. And in the decorations of that tomb, one of the images we see here is the building of some kind of bier for the deceased king Amenhotep I. I'm interested in all this imagery up here, which is for protecting the deceased king. And I'm particularly interested in these two images of Bess, who guards or protects the king. I'm likewise interested in a wealth of amulets that come to us from the Egyptian context that show this drum playing Bess, and I think this drum playing Bess performing his protective role. You're seeing just several examples here. An example here of the mold that was used to make this kind of amulet. More examples here, and notably here, an example that comes from the Israelite context, from the site of Beit Shan. And here, yet more examples that come from Beit Shan, from the Israelite context, and here within the Iron Age period, which was the period of ancient Israel. So my suggestion to you is all of this drumming on Bess's part is protective, and while that cannot conclusively prove that my drum-playing female figurines also are performing this protective role, I'd like to suggest the evidence is compelling, if not absolutely definitive. Finally, it's compelling to me in this regard to think that these other figurines that come to us from ancient Israel, we have about 60 of these. They are not connected with a model shrine. Instead, they are found in domestic contexts. They can be found in tomb context. They can be found in public buildings. They can be found in streets and courtyards. But that these figurines were likewise drum players who, in whatever context they were located, whether it was a home, whether it was a tomb, whether it was a public building, whether it was a shrine, whether it was a public courtyard, these drum players, too, were envisioned as beating on their drums as a protective role. That, like the figures from our various model shrines, we're looking at a large corpus of these female figurines whose role in the ancient world was to drum away demons as they protected both human and divine beings from whatever malevolent agents might seek to do them harm. Thanks.
So I think we have time for some questions. I'll let Professor Ackerman field the questions for you.
Yes, ma'am.
I just wondered why you wouldn't think of them as baby shrines instead of model shrines, meaning they could be real shrines themselves.
So they are usually called in the literature model shrines because they are envisioned to be models of full-scale shrines. There's no reason that they can't also be shrines themselves. And although we don't know the fine spot of many of these shrines, some of them we do know were found in domestic context. So you could envision within a home, a family having one of these small shrines that functioned as a small scale shrine within their home that they would use in precisely that kind of way. We have a couple of examples where there is a dab of clay at the very back of the shrine, and that dab of clay suggests there was some image of a god or of a goddess that must have been affixed to the back who was understood to be the occupant of that shrine. So I think they absolutely are functional, even as they are models, only in the sense that they are scaled down models of what a full-scale shrine would be. Thank you. Yes, sir.
So I can easily see how the lions could be a measure of protection and fear. What are your thoughts as to why women were chosen rather than men to fulfill that function? And is there any current speculation, I've always gone back and forth, that these statues have some sexual reference, some sacred prostitution? I mean, the genital area on that figure is rather, you know, clear and explicit.
Yeah. So thanks for asking that question. That's actually, your question is exactly what got me started on this problem in the first place. I am first and foremost a biblical scholar. I was trying to finish what I wanted to be, and I hope is, I'm still doing the final touches on it, but I was trying to write a book on women and the religion of ancient Israel. I wanted it to be a synthetic, comprehensive look of everything we might be able to say about women and the religion of ancient Israel. And I knew I needed to talk about Exodus 38:8, the women who were at the entrance to the tent of meeting. You shouldn't talk about women in ancient Israel if you're not willing to talk about those women in that particular religious context. So it's women that got me started on this, exactly this problem. What I've come to think, you may not agree, but I'm going to just drive you crazy by flipping through PowerPoints really fast here. But what I have come to think is that as we think about these guardian figures, and let me maybe start with this one. As we think about these guardian figures, not always, but quite often, these guardian figures are what we would call in the religion biz liminal figures. They are figures who are betwixt and between. They are figures here, for example, with a human head, a lion's body, and winged. Or in these very famous Assyrian examples, again, a human head, either a lion's or bull body, and winged. They are somehow betwixt and between real animals and a divine being. They're not of this world. Women, in a very different way, in the ancient world, in a very patriarchal world in many respects, are also kind of betwixt and between figures. The norm in the ancient world is the male, and women are not considered the sort of normative representative of humanity. They are, for example, the people who always have to leave their homes to go live in their husband's home. So they are not of their natal home. And they are, once they leave, they're always somehow other within that home. They're not fully integrated. They're not fully apart. And so my argument about why women is because women are good intermediaries. They are not the perfect representative in this case of humanity. Let me just say, in terms of sacred prostitution, I don't believe there was sacred prostitution in the ancient world, so that's one of the reasons I would discount sacred prostitution. I'm happy to answer that longer, but I've talked too long about women. Yes?
I have a question. I'm interested in the placement of the human on the left side.
Mm-hmm.
They all have that, right?
They all have this. So the most characteristic posture is to hold the disc with your left hand cupped here and your right hand on top of it. Mm-hmm. It seems what's going on here, all of these figures are made by pressing clay into a mold, right? So you have a stone mold and you press clay into it. The technology of that means that your figure has to be relatively flat. What we really should probably be envisioning are people who are holding a drum out from their chest and beating it like this. Beating a drum like this is not going to make a very good noise. But I think technologically, you pretty much have to render it like this simply because it's difficult to make that image, to make that kind of plaque, given the technology of mold-made figurines. There are some so-called pillar-based figurines, which are more in the round, more three-dimensional, and they actually do show the drum being held this way. So I think really what our artists are trying to do is show a drum player within the limits of trying to do it within a certain kind of technology. Yes, yes. They definitely envision that you beat on the drum with your right hand. Yeah. Yes, sir?
All right, this question will probably sound is coming out of left field, but I will ask it anyway. Looking at these figurines who are guarding these entrances to these temples, I at least couldn't help but think of the figure Rahab from the Book of Joshua, whose home, the Book of Joshua tells us, was in the wall of the city, so sort of on the perimeter of the city of Jericho. And obviously she does not perform a protective function in the story. She, on the contrary, she actually very much enables the Israelites to conquer the city, and as a result, land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't help but, I wanted to ask, is it helpful to think of these female figurines guarding entrances, admittedly to these holy, these temples or these model shrines, is that a relevant background for thinking about the Israelites entering into the city of Jericho? Is there, as a kind of subversion of this notion of the female figure exercising this liminal function of guardianship.
I haven't thought about that. I mean, one of the things your question immediately makes me think of is, you say Rahab is not performing a protective role. It depends whose side you're on. I mean, she saves the life of the Israelites.
She's not defending the city.
Yeah.
She's subverted.
Yeah. But she saves she saves the life of these spies by lowering them out of a window, which for my purposes is since breaches, entryways are important, that's kind of interesting. The reason I flipped to this slide is I've never thought about this before, so I'm on the fly here a little bit. But the reason I flipped to this particular slide is to show you this particular example here. This comes from Rehov, ancient Rehov, and you can see the flanking females here, right, which is what interests me, flanking an entryway. But this is not a model shrine per se. It's not one of these little boxes, right? It's a slightly different architectural something, and the excavators have interpreted it as a city gate. So good for you to think about the way that females might also perform that function at a city gate. That's nice. Yes?
As you were talking, I understood the thesis you came up with, because obviously a woman would be not having holding a gun, or they didn't have guns, but other protective things to hurt people with, because I don't think that was envisioned in those times. So, but did you come up with any ulterior theses as to why they were holding the disc when you were...
I'm not sure this is quite going to answer your question, but again, let me just drive you crazy by flipping around a little bit here. I do think, especially in this text, which is the text that got me started, after all. So they're protecting the God of Israel, who is resident inside this tent, right? They're not worried about things that you need a sword for or things like that. They're not worried about, the God of Israel presumably can protect God's self from, some rampaging Canaanite who wants to get inside the tent of meeting. I think they're worried about supernatural agents. I think they're worried about the kind of demonic agents who can slip by unseen and who could get into that tent and who somehow damage or pollute the space of the God of Israel. Right? So they need weapons that are good for demons. Right? So they don't need actual physical weapons like swords and knives. They need things that are going to scare demons. And my thesis was that drums are a thing that scare demons. But I also, and that's why I wanted to show you this slide, I believe mirrors scare demons away. And it may be exactly because of this same way that Bess can scare demons away. What happens when a demon sees its own image in a mirror, that the demon is so deterred by its own malevolent features that it leaves. So I think these mirrors should be interpreted as another weapon that women at the entryway to a shrine space can wield. Yes?
How do you know the mirrors aren't actually bronze discs that they're holding, the ones that you were calling drums? I don't know about the textual history of this. It's clear what Jerome thought they were, but round disc mirrors were at least common in the classical world. And of course, one of the ways to make noise is with a sort of gong, mm-hmm. and it's suspended and hit. Now, clearly, they just have a hand and a disc that's not working that way. But I didn't realize until you brought this passage back. Is it also mirrors in the Hebrew Bible? Is that definitely what they are?
The word only shows up here in the Hebrew Bible, so it's not quite definite what it is, but it's a word that is based off the verb to see, so it looks like something where you see yourself. So mirrors is a, I think, perfectly acceptable translation. When I first presented, you're not the first people who have heard this, I'm sorry to tell you, which is maybe good, like maybe I've gotten better at it, but when I first presented this, that's exactly the first question that came up, is why say those are drums? Why not say those are mirrors? I think there's a couple of things to think about there if you could see the objects a little bit more closely, and I know that you can't really hear when you're looking at something like this. But one is mirrors in the ancient world typically have a handle. Right? We have plenty of representations, especially from ancient Egypt, and we have plenty of mirrors that we have found from Egypt and also from Israel, that it is a polished bronze disc on a handle. So you would expect that the holding position for holding a mirror would be holding with a handle. These discs are also decorated sometimes, and they're decorated in a pretty distinctive way that has decoration around the sides that looks like what the artist is trying to represent is the nails that would have hammered into the wooden frame to hold a skin in place, or the lacing that would have been used, the leather thongs that would have been used to hold the skin in place. So I'm no art historian, but what the art historians say is it's a drum, and I have gone with that. I will say, in just one more, in a much longer version of this paper, I have a lot of material that I dearly love, especially from the classical world, about banging on bronze as a way to drive away demons. Just one example, the bronze cauldrons that are said to surround the shrine at Dodona, and that the banging on those bronze was supposed to be protective. So I'm very interested in banging on bronze, too.
Is there any connection between deaths and the use of knives to protect women in childbirth, and then the tradition, even in this day, of Lilith with the knife under the pillow in childbirth?
Wow. That's a great question, and the answer is I have no earthly idea. I am someone, I'm afraid, who is so deeply embedded in the ancient world that traditions of post-biblical interpretation, which is where that Lilith material comes from, are just not things I have worked on very much. My guess would be no, that there's really too much of a chronological and a geographical gap, but I just don't know. I can tell you, just to show you that I actually have read something after the year 100, there's a fabulous article that was published now almost 100 years ago in the Hebrew Union College annual about medieval Jewish traditions about weddings, and that the origin of the tradition of breaking a glass is not at all to commemorate the, you know, destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. It's because demons are really attracted to happy occasions, and you need to protect the bride and groom from demons. And there's two ways you can do that. One is to make sure the demons can't see the bride and groom, so you need to have a chuppah over them so they can't look down and see the bride and groom, and you need to scare them away with loud noise, and that's what breaking the glass does.
I feel you're bundling the visible demons and invisible demons. Like, I went through a dermatology residency learning that a lot of the invisible demons were people with congenital syphilis or people with syndromes who looked bizarre or were mentally deficient, and they were misbehaving, or there was no social network to support them, and they were just left on the street. So do we know if the ancient people also bundled invisible demons and visible demons?
That's a really good question, and the answer is I don't know. I do know, this doesn't answer your question, but I do know that the next part of this project needs to be to think a lot more about what are actually identified as demonic agents in the Bible and see what can be said about that, and I just haven't gotten there yet. So, good calling me out there. Yes, sir.
If the aim is to make a lot of noise to drive demons away, you think at least in some cases you have floor standing drums which make deeper, louder sounds. Why don't we see any?
I suspect, and the answer is I don't know totally, but here's what I suspect, is that one of the things we are seeing here is the evidence of the essentially economic impoverishment of ancient Israel and their neighbors in Jordan. Is while it is in Mesopotamia, where they do clearly have these big copper drums, and there are several different words for drum in ancient Mesopotamian language, and they're all different kinds of drums, but most of them are metal. But in Mesopotamia, which is a much richer culture, they've got a lot more metal to work with. And metal is a very rare and precious commodity within the ancient Israelite and ancient Jordanian context. And they don't have the opportunity to make drums in that kind of way. Peter.
So the top left and top right are some examples that you show were very similar to these, where there is neither a drum nor a lion. I wonder if there's either a functional or chronological difference that you can identify when the lion comes in, when the drum comes in, or if these are doing something different, but they're very different postures.
I cannot identify for you a chronological difference per se. Having said that, you know, this is usually taken to be the oldest in my sample, so circa 1200 or so, but it's unprovenance, so what you can't say for sure. This is usually taken to be the oldest, circa 1200. This one is usually taken to be 11th century or 10th century, so not much later, and there's lions right there, so it's hard to do much with that. I will say, if you just want to, well, maybe I'll say this just to you because I know what you've worked on, is here's a place where there is a significant difference in the iconography, is with the exception of this, which comes from Rehov, right, which is right on the Jordan River on the Israel side. I cannot give you an example from the heartland of ancient Israel that has flanking female figurines. Those tend to be much more Jordanian, so on the east bank of the Jordan River, or they tend, as this one, to be Edomite, deep in the south of Israel. What you much more typically find in Israel is trees flanking the entryway. And my suspicion, and I happen to know Peter has worked on trees, is my suspicion is that those trees are somehow to be understood as performing that same protective role that they are, if you will, symbolic equivalents on those model shrines of Yakin and Boaz in the temple in Jerusalem, and that there is something about that aniconic tradition that we find reflected in at least certain Israelite texts that is driving the Israelites away from putting naked figurines flanking an entryway and putting something more abstracted instead. But that's the, when I originally conceived of this project, its title was Mirrors, Drums, and Trees, and there was going to be a whole long, and there's a whole long paper on mirrors, and there's a whole long paper that you heard an extract from on drums, and trees is coming.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.